baseball fans, as well as you fantasy fans out there. Welcome to today's podcast, a podcast to be named later. I am your host, Chris Mitchell, and we've got a phenomenal guest today. We're going to be talking about the future of fantasy baseball, or really fantasy sports in general, but our guest today has been one of the legends in the fantasy baseball community. We're going to be talking with Ron Chandler today of ronchandler.com. He's also the author of The Baseball Forecaster, which was just a winner of the FSWA award for a best publication. It's a well-respected, well-regarded, essentially the best baseball forecaster out there, at least one of the best few. A lot of people would say it's the best. A few would argue that it's at least in the top 10, at least in the top couple. But the fact is, it's a well-respected journal and a well-respected yearly book that goes out there. And so we're going to be talking with Ron Chandler today. Very excited about it. I hope I'm not mumbling too much here. I'm trying to get my train of thought. But Ron is a very well-respected person in this industry, and I'm very excited to be able to talk with him today. And I'd also like to thank him for taking the time out, because I'm writing an article right now for Baseball America about the future of daily fantasy sports. And I'm trying to talk to industry experts. I'm also trying to talk to legal members to talk about the issues. And so not only am I going to be able to have Ron on here for a little while, which is very exciting, but I'm also going to be using this information to hopefully take part in the article and give everybody some context on what's going on when it comes to daily fantasy sports. So that's what the podcast is intended for today. But we've got a lot to talk with Ron. Again, ronchandler.com, author of The Baseball Forecaster, in its 30th year. He's been doing it for that long, 30 years, a well-respected book, no doubt about it. And it's the new Ron Chandler's other book, 2016, is another one out there. Anything Ron does, I would highly recommend you go out there and check out. And if you want to follow him on Facebook, you can do that as well. It's ronchandler.baseball. And, of course, you can always find everybody on Twitter at Ron Chandler. But let me bring him in today. Again, this is a podcast to be named later. You can follow me on Facebook as well. But let me bring Ron into the program today. Ron, I really appreciate you taking the time out today. And again, congratulations on your award, and just glad to have you on.
Well, thanks, Chris. I appreciate you having me. It's my pleasure to join you today.
30 years with the baseball. Well, let's talk a little bit about you, and then we'll get into the issue of daily fantasy sports. But 30 years doing The Baseball Forecaster, what was it like? What was fantasy sports like 30 years ago when you first started doing the book?
Well, it was shortly after the Rotisserie League Baseball book was published in 1984 by Dan O'Krant and Glenn Wagner, and they kind of opened the world to the whole idea of fantasy and rotisserie baseball. And there were a few early authors back then, but basically everything was manual. I mean, there were no commissioner services. There was no Internet back then. So if you wanted to be in the league, it had to be with a bunch of your close friends. You had to have your draft live with these other people. There was no online drafting. And every time you had to do the stats, it was manually. I mean, some people had some of the early personal computers with Lotus 1-2-3, some of the early spreadsheets, VisiCalc, and they did their stats on spreadsheets. But for the most part, it was a very labor-intensive. You really had to be dedicated. You really had to want to do this to play, because it was a lot of work back then.
Yeah, I don't go quite that far back. I am older than 30, but I wasn't playing fantasy sports when I was 12, which is a rarity. 12-year-olds play now routinely. My first experience with fantasy sports was on America Online, when the Internet was first kind of getting up, where it kind of went mainstream, where everyone had the Internet. The Internet's been around for a lot longer than that. But when America Online got started, that's when I started playing fantasy sports with a site called StatsBB. I don't know if you remember that, but it was a points league. And that was my first, and that was probably 20 years ago. How big of a difference, like you said, you really had to be dedicated before the Internet. Did it change any of the fundamentals of fantasy sports to go from where you had to literally comb through the box scores to do it, and then when sites like StatsBB or all these other ones started, was there any fundamental changes to how fantasy sports was, or did it just make it easier to play?
Well, certainly it made it easier to play. It allowed for a lot more flexibility with the rules, for one thing. Because back then, if you had any automated system, it was very rigid as to how you would be able to play the game. But once the Internet came about and then different commissioner services and whatnot, you weren't restricted to just a 4x4 game or just certain types of trades or certain types of players. Now, any way you can think of playing fantasy, you can play it. You can find a site that can support it. back then it was a very rigid. You can only make single player trades. The very first fantasy leagues had no reserve list. The game just kind of exploded once it came online.
Now let me ask you this, and then we'll get into the data frame. So I'm just fascinated by how you did things way back when. When it went from no internet and manual participation to the internet, obviously I would have expected an explosion. Now we've got daily fantasy sports and almost like a new explosion. How would you compare those, would you say, innovations that catapulted the industry forward? I guess that's how I would place it. How would you compare those two changes in the industry?
Well, there were huge changes. The internet was clearly a huge change, and I think it's tough to classify DFS right now because we're really not sure how this is going to end up because of all the legal stuff that's going on now. So I think once the dust clears a little bit, we'll have a better idea of how big this could be or whether we need to pull back a little bit. And the same thing happened back in the late 90s because the internet came and we had the huge explosion, and then we had the dot-com bust in 1999-2000. So there was a lot of consolidation within the industry. Whereas one day you had 50 companies doing something, the next day you had five. And I think we may be going through somewhat of a similar situation now. So until we go through that cycle and see exactly what's going to this new sector of the industry, what's going to look like in a couple of years, it's really hard to judge exactly how it's going to change things.
Yeah, and I do want to compare a little bit of the yearly league to daily. And I think maybe one place to start is when it comes to the money. That we're not going to get into the legal issues. I'm not going to ask you to give your legal opinion on these issues. You're not a lawyer, and I wouldn't expect you to give me those kinds of analysis because I'm not qualified to even debate it, really. But how important do you think the money aspect is to daily? If you got rid of it, and I do want to get into some of the hybrid – I call it hybrid – some of the hybrid leagues that you've created – If daily did end up having to remove the monetary aspect to it, would that kill it? Because I would enjoy playing daily even if it had no money. Picking lineups every single day, to me, for as far as a hobby goes, is interesting. Do you think that'll play a significant impact on the popularity and success in the future of it? I guess my question is, how important is the money element to daily fantasy sports, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think the money element is hugely important. You say you enjoy it even without the money. Well, we did a survey probably about 3 or 4 years ago asking folks how important the money was to the enjoyment and the competitiveness of playing both full season and daily. And you'd be a part of the 3% who enjoy playing daily, enjoy playing daily without money. It's a very big, very big aspect of the game, not only for just the incentive of playing, but also it's the metric that people use to determine the success. Whereas in a full season league, you follow the standings, you manage your roster. At the end of the season, you know where you are. But in daily, because it's a constant process on a day to day basis, especially in baseball, the measuring stick that people use is how much money they've won. So it really changes the entire complexion of the game. And in fact, DFS is, in some aspects, a very, very different game than full season. And the fact that we're kind of lumping it all together, I think, does neither of them any justice.
Yeah, and I do want to talk with you about that, the little bit of the comparison. Because we have been playing yearly leagues for a very long time, and money has been involved in yearly leagues for a very long time, and nobody has really cared about that as far as legislation. And no states that I know of are coming in and making big issues out of yearly leagues. And if they did, maybe I could have missed it, of course, in the last 30 years. But, it's a yearly league versus a daily interaction. So I guess since both of them do have money, but they are very different formats, what's your opinion on how DFS has, I guess, what are the elements that make daily fantasy sports so exciting? Let me go here. I'm trying to figure out the question here.
Sure.
If you remove the money, if you still allow the money, you still got it in yearly, but you've also still got it in daily. I'm just wondering, what's the impact, I guess, on the yearly leagues? I enjoy it. I love dynasty leagues, are my favorite. So not only do I want to play yearly, I want to play long term yearly. I like to build organizations. So for me, that's the most enjoying part of fantasy sports. But obviously, what's the impact, do you think, of daily fantasy sports in this craze we're going through right now on the yearly league?
Well, I I think the thing that's been driving daily fantasy sports is the fact that it feeds into our need for immediate gratification. You know, we have short attention spans as it is since the internet, that it's just gotten shorter and shorter. So DFS feeds into that. Whereas, you know, the full season game, there's a more engagement that leads to a longer term outcome. And that's why it's a completely different mindset playing one versus the other. I think that's why the money is so important in the daily game, because it's the validation of the effort that you're putting into it. Whereas in the full season game, you're okay with playing it for 6 months because the money at the end is a nice little prize, but you're not playing it necessarily for the money. You're playing it for the challenge and the daily interaction that builds into something bigger. You know, once you win a full season league, I think there's a huge sense of satisfaction at having, you know, gone through a battle and won. Whereas winning on one night in DFS is like, okay, that's great, I did it, but now I got to go back again. So I think the satisfaction level is at a different tier. Again, they're really two different mindsets in playing these two different hobbies.
Yeah, absolutely. Are there any other elements you think that, other than the instant gratification and the instant monetary impact, are there any other key elements? Because I want to kind of slide and kind of transition right into how you created some of these other kind of, as I called it, hybrid leagues. Are there any other elements that you've thought about that maybe impact daily other than the quick monetary aspect and the quick set? Because if you're doing yearlies, there is a day-to-day satisfaction. You know, my guy hit two home runs today, or my guy threw a shutout. I understand that's not quite as gratifying as doing daily, but there is at least some gratification there. Are there other elements you think in daily that brings people to the game?
Well, I mean, there are different decision points that you have to consider, and that's why it makes it a very completely different game. Now, full season leagues that have daily transactions are very similar in this regard too. But in a full season league, you're not concerned about the weather, you're not concerned about matchups per se, unless you're in a daily transaction league. Whereas in the DFS game, that's everything. You have to be concerned about weather. You have to be concerned about the ballpark of a particular game is being played in, lefty versus righty matchups, you know, up and down your lineup. These are more granular type of decisions that you have to make in the daily game that you don't have, for the most part, in full season. And that's why it kind of, again, makes it a very different game.
And just to backtrack a little, how long has daily fantasy sports been, I guess, a thing? I've been doing it for 2 or 3 or 4 years, either following it or heard about it, but it's been, how long has daily actually been a thing where people have been playing for money? How long has that been going on? I honestly, it's a craze now. I was aware of it last year, but I'm curious, when did daily actually start?
2009. FanDuel was first out into the market in 2009 with the daily game, and it picked up steam rather quickly. By 2012 was when DraftKings, DraftStreet, some of the others started coming on. So FanDuel basically had a monopoly for a couple of years until the others started coming on, but it grew exponentially after that.
And do you? And if I'm posing a question here that you don't know, by all means, I'm probably asking too much here. But when FanDuel first got started, let's say the second or third year it was going, what's the difference in how many people were playing then versus how many people were playing before New York put a freeze on things?
Yeah, I really don't know the answer to that. I'm sorry.
But you would say exponentially larger, I assume. It's grown significantly?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about it. Now, I track website traffic for Baseball HQ, which I used to run, and I would look at all the competitor sites and all the other sites in the industry to see, you know, what traffic counts look like. And the daily fantasy sites, over the course of just a three-year period, the growth was like nothing I'd ever seen from any company that I'd ever tracked before. It was incredible.
Yeah, and if anyone who saw the Frontline documentary on PBS this past week or so, the CEO or one of the high-ranking officers of FanDuel, said that they're getting 20 to 30,000 people signing up every day, not every week or not every quarter, but every day. I mean, think about that, 20 or 30,000 new players signing up and making monetary deposits every single day. That is, I'd have to say, going all the way back to when you first started playing fantasy sports, every single day, that is exponentially larger than I think we've maybe ever seen in maybe anything. I mean, that's crazy. That is a significant number.
Yeah, I mean, these are huge numbers, and that's why they've started to draw the attention of legislators and then the government, because once you start having that many numbers for an industry that's essentially unregulated, then people want to have their own piece of the pie, and that's kind of what we saw this past fall when things started falling apart.
Yeah, and now I want to get into those hybrid leagues, because I remember talking with a friend of mine, Lenny Melnick, and his significant other was playing in one of your hybrid leagues, and I really thought it was fascinating. I loved the elements of strategy and thought that went into that league, and I'm curious, when you were trying to create these leagues, what was the thought process on putting together the formats and why you came up with the rules? I guess start by explaining the leagues that you've started, and then I'm curious in the mindset and the thought process that went into creating them, creating the formats, creating the rules and things like that. I'm very curious why and how you did that.
Sure, and really it was an outgrowth of the whole fact that we do have more of a need for immediate gratification, and one of the reasons that baseball as a sport has fallen far behind football is because it's just an incredibly long season, and you know even in your full season leagues, once July and August rolls around, if your team's not contending or at least has a shot to contending, you're losing interest. It's tough to hang out for a whole 6 months for a lot of this stuff. So I thought, well, rather than a full-season league, and, you know, daily was kind of first starting to gain some legs at that point, I thought, well, why don't we have a different time period? Why don't we try maybe a monthly league? So I basically put together this format for a monthly league, and the thought process was that there's really one or two things that could happen here. Either the monthly concept itself gains some acceptance because it's sort of like a midway ground between full-season and daily, and it gives you both the opportunity to do a lot of the smaller short-term tactical decision-making that goes on in daily, while at the same time being able to follow the standings on a day-to-day basis, which is what's missing from daily. You don't have that drama of you know, like opening up the morning newspaper and seeing where your team is in the standings. And being able to interact with your team and have some managerial control of moving it forward in the standings. So in a monthly league, we had that, and the research had showed that, and there was some pushback because people thought, well, month is not really long enough for the statistics to stabilize. But in fact, in full season leagues, 80% of the teams that are in the top four spots in your league, one of those teams is going to end up winning 80% of the time. So there is some research behind the fact that month is a long enough period to determine the general strengths and weaknesses of a particular roster. So that was part of the thought process. The other thought process was, if DFS happened to go belly up, because I was always, you know, on the fence, thinking that there might be some legal problem down the road with this thing. If DFS went belly up, monthly might be a safe harbor for people to gravitate towards. So that was kind of the thought process for putting together. But as it turned out, it couldn't really gain a foothold, and people who were too bored with full season we're going straight to the daily game and not trying to take a chance with monthly, so it never really worked out, unfortunately.
Yeah. Do you think it could, or do you think the response you've got is enough to kind of give you the idea that it just won't?
No, I think it was a great concept, and the feedback I got from those people who played it was fully positive. We just couldn't get enough people to play because everybody was trying DFS, and because of the whole money aspect and the quick turnaround of results, nobody really stopped to take a look at monthly. But I think, you know, down the line, if things change and if there's a significant pushback to DFS, so with all the legal stuff going on, monthly might have some opportunities later on.
We're talking with Ron Chandler of ronchandler.com. He's also the author of The Baseball Forecaster, which has won an award, an FSWA award. Great book. He's been doing this for 30 years. He's also got out Ron Chandler's other book, 2016. You can find him on Facebook, ronchandler.baseball, and you can also follow him on Twitter, at Ron Chandler. And Ron, there, as you mentioned, there's a lot going on with the legal aspects of it with daily and DFS. Do you think that there are issues with DFS as far as it needs to be regulated or anything like that? What do you think I'm curious, does the industry need to be regulated? I'm curious what your thoughts are when it comes to that.
Yeah, I think something needs to be done. I don't think people play on a level playing field in these games, especially in tournament play. You know, there's always been the question of skill versus chance, and I think that's not – I think that's a faulty discussion, actually, because there's elements of both skill and chance in this game, and it depends upon the format. Now, if you play in a single-entry 50-50 game, I think that's a perfectly logical and fine game, a lot of fun and challenging and very, very skill-based, because if your goal is to only finish in the top half of all competitors, you can use skill indicators to be able to determine the best roster to field in any given night, and it works, and it works rather well. And you can actually, you know, if you still use money as your metric, you still can make a fair amount of money doing that. But the problem is that the companies are selling the big, huge million-dollar prizes, and they're leading people to think that they can drop $3 down in a tournament and win $1 million. And that is where we start getting into trouble, because the people who are winning these tournaments, more often than not, are those who are fielding hundreds and maybe thousands of teams. And I think that's where this thing goes off the rails. When you have the ability to field an almost unlimited number of chances, you know, it's like going into a casino and putting money on every single number on a roulette wheel, or betting on 25 out of the 30 teams to win in baseball for 1 year. I mean, the more chances you get, the more you cover your risk, and the higher the odds of you winning. And so the guy who's only going in and putting one chip down, who's only betting on one team, his odds, you know, even though he might have a chance, his odds are a lot lower because he's got fewer overall chances compared to others. And I think that's where things kind of get off the rails in DFS. And that, I think that's one of the areas that's probably going to be addressed more than others.
Yeah, and would you agree or disagree that most people who play in those tournaments have no idea what they're going up against as far as people using technology, like you said, using 900 lineups in one tournament? Do you think the people, the general person that throws down $3 and enters once, do you think they're just not educated and therefore they're going in completely blind? Or do you think they're just dismissing that? Or do you think that is fundamentally unfair?
Yeah, and I do think it's unfair. And I think most people don't recognize what they're up against, because needless to say, the companies, the game companies are not promoting that. You know, the statistic came out last year that in the first half of last baseball season, something like 90% of the cash was won by less than 2% of the participants. So, I mean, that's a testament to the fact that it is a skill-based game, because you couldn't do that if it wasn't skill-based. But it's also a testament to the fact that people are not playing on a level playing field, and that is that's a big problem.
And if the sites did educate people, and if people like us talked about it so everybody knew what they were getting into, if we raised the level of education and knowledge when it came to this thing, would that significantly improve the fairness of it, or are there still fundamental problems, in your opinion?
No, I think there's still fundamental underlying problems. More education will help, and maybe it will decrease the amount of fish that are at the bottom of the pool. But the fewer fish there is, the less money there's going to be had, too. And between that and any possibility of these games being taxed, which seems a pretty high odds of that, is going to decrease the chances of these companies being able to offer as big a prizes as they had before. You look at the National Fantasy Baseball Championship and Fantasy Football Championship. You know, they offer prizes of $100,000, $250,000, but your buy-in is $1,500. You can't buy in for $3 and win $100,000. And that's the promise that DFS is making, that they're not going to be able to sustain. So I think if they offered leagues where, yeah, you can win your $1 million, but you have to buy in for, you know, $5,000 or something like that, that would be more fair. But I don't know if that's a sustainable business model, especially certainly not at the level that they're running it at now.
Then you'd have a professional league, and you'd probably have products and names rather than hundreds of thousands of entries, right?
Yeah, but you know, casinos have the high stakes tables too, and if you're willing to play a $1 game, you're not going to be able to go to a high stakes table, and you're not going to be able to win the big bucks.
And do you think if the education was raised, if people realized that there were mathematicians out there creating algorithms in computer software that are helping them pick lineups, and that they're entering 700 times, if everybody was fully informed, almost like they had to take a class before they were allowed to sign up, do you think that would have a significant role in reducing the number of players? Do you think that level of – is information and knowledge enough that people would just run from it, or do you think it would not really matter?
I don't think it'll matter because everybody is playing the lottery right now. And, I mean, it's pretty apparent what the odds are of you winning the lottery. You know, Powerball was with how many was ridiculous amount of money a few weeks ago, and it just lured more people in, knowing that the odds were just ridiculous. It was the odds of, you know, it's one out of every person in the country, basically. It's the type of odds you have, but people were still playing it. And it was pretty obvious that the odds of winning were low, but, you know, it's the old saying, someone's got to win. So why not me? So even though you know the odds are stacked against you, whatever you're buying is, it always gives you a chance. You know, like Jim Carrey says on Dumb and Dumber, you know, so I have a chance, you know.
Yeah,
people,
exactly.
One in a million. It's a chance. It's a chance.
Yeah. And I don't think people realize that the reason why the Powerball got so large is because they've added numbers now. So you have to pick more numbers, which makes the odds even more difficult to win, but it makes it more enticing because now you don't have $300 million pools. You've got $1.3 billion pools, but the odds were – I mean, you can get hit by lightning twice more likely than you winning the lottery, and now it's even worse. Now you could get hit by lightning like four times before you could possibly win the lottery. So they've made it tougher to win. The odds are even longer, and yet more and more people are playing, and the jackpots are getting larger and larger. People don't realize that, but it's like it gets it harder to win, and therefore everyone else wants to do it even more. That's kind of the craziness that comes with this kind of stuff, I suppose.
It's crazy, but I mean, I have a confession to make. When I first got married, my wife and I used to play the lottery every week because we didn't have much money. We figured, what the heck? Well, when this Powerball thing, hit $1 billion, it was like, well, what the heck? I'll throw in $20 and see what happens. And so they got my $20. You know, I didn't win, but it was just like it's just like, well, why not? You know, and I have to think that in DFS it's very similar. You know, it's like, oh, what the hell, $3. You know, someone's got to win. Maybe it's my $3. And it's pocket change. It's disposable income. It's throwaway money. So yeah, I'll spend 15 minutes and put a lineup together. You know, whatever. You know, they think there's more randomness to it, but there is skill, and that's the situation, is the appearance of randomness when there is some skill involved, and especially those who are able to enter hundreds and thousands of lineups. It just shifts the odds away from you.
Now, I live in Massachusetts. I don't know where you live, but in New York, from every, because again, preparing the article, it looks like New York wants to get rid of it, or at least that's the stance they're taking at the moment. In Massachusetts, where I am, they don't want to get rid of daily fantasy sports. They just want to regulate it and inform people like we've been talking about here. So every state seems to have a different approach to the issues and a different approach to how to handle these things. So it's tough. I'm not going to ask you any legal opinions. You're not a lawyer. You don't play one on television or here on the radio, as far as I know. But what do you think? Right now, in this murky world we live in when it comes to fantasy sports right now, I'm going to pose a question to you anyway. What do you think is the future of daily fantasy sports right now?
Well, I think ultimately there's going to be some regulation, but the things over the next few years are going to get very, very crazy because the federal government's completely staying out of this. So this is really a state issue, and all of the states basically want to handle this differently. So the Fantasy Sports Trade Association has got now lobbyists and attorneys out in many, many states, and they're basically going to work through the entire country over the next few years trying to advocate for making this legal and doing whatever regulation is necessary to keep this as a viable industry. But that means potentially 50 different sets of regulations and rules, and that really is going to muddy the waters a lot. You know, your AG in Massachusetts actually came up with some potential proposal for a way to regulate the industry, you know, separating the beginners leagues from more advanced leagues and things like that sort. And, you know, looking at the list of regs that proposed, I think they got it, you know, probably about 80 or 85% right. There were a few things that probably could not fly, but was one of the stronger stances and positive steps in trying to move this towards something that benefits everybody. The New York AG trying to shut the whole thing down, I think, is mostly just grandstanding. You know, it's at the conference in Dallas last month for the Trade Association. There was a former attorney general who said, you know, in most, basically AG stands for aspiring governor. So these attorney generals are basically trying to make a name for themselves, and they're campaigning to become the next governor. So they're taking a stand, and sometimes it's an unreasonable stand. And in fact, the AG in Texas, where the conference was, ruled fantasy sports illegal on the first day of the conference. So the timing was deliberate, and, you know, it's, again, trying to make a statement. We just really don't know what it's going to look like once the dust clears. I imagine there's going to be some taxation. That seems to be inevitable because they're always going to want to have a piece of the pie and take whatever they can. The thing is, now, that's not the overriding driving force, because as much money is being exchanged right now, when you start breaking it down and taking small percentages to feed the states, what you end up with is really not a whole lot of money. You know, the state's not going to be chasing after $100,000. It's just, you know, it needs to be bigger, and conceivably the pie will become bigger, but it's just not there yet. But I think the fact that there's not a level playing field, the fact that there's the gambling implications, the fact that there are people complaining, and there's, you know, the threat of insider trading because there are no regulations, I think that those are the loopholes that are going to be closed up first. And, you know, once those are all done, I think we're going to end up with a very, very different game at the end. I think the amount of cash, the cash prize sizes are probably going to change. The rules are probably going to change. It will be a somewhat different game, but I think the whole concept of a daily competition is not going anywhere. It's the market has already spoken, saying that they love this concept. We just have to find a way that meets the litmus test of these legislators.
Yeah, I actually have a call into the AG's office. I'm hoping to do an interview either today or tomorrow with somebody over there. I'm hoping to be able to get the AG of Massachusetts on the horn, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to swing that one. I do have some political connections up here, but I don't know if I'll be able to swing that, never mind as a podcast, but I do have some calls in, and I am going to try to get somebody on the record for my article there. One thing that I found interesting about one of the Massachusetts regs, like you said, is that they want to put a monetary limit and almost make you apply. Where depending on how much income you make, they'll limit how much you're allowed to deposit and things like that. That's one of the things that was floated as a possible regulation. I don't know how you enforce that or how that goes about, but it seems reasonable in theory, but I wonder how reasonable it is in practice and whether it'll actually come to fruition or not. But that's one of the things it looks like Massachusetts is trying to do.
Right, and that was one of the items that clearly is not going to be able to fly, because, like you said, how do you regulate that? How do you really keep track of that? I mean, that opens up a whole can of worms as to setting up whole new systems to being able to monitor that, and I don't think that's the direction you really need to go to. But, I mean, there are things that can be done, and, again, not being a lawyer and not knowing what we can do within the bounds of legality, the limits what the ideas could be from my end anyway, but again, something's going to have to happen.
And being that you're an insider in the fantasy world, have you heard any of the possible changes, or have you heard about speculation or anything like that, that some of those changes that you discussed are probably coming? Have you heard any specifics or details on some of the changes that could be coming, or is it just change is coming and FanDuel and DraftKings and all those sites will adapt when it comes, but we just don't know how?
Yeah, I don't think we really know what is going to happen next, because right now the primary battles right now are with the states that want to shut it down completely. And, you know, we need to be able to keep that door at least slightly open on those states so we can have room to negotiate. So that, I think those states that are saying, you know, this is definitely illegal, those are the states that have to be looked at first, and that's what the trade association is doing right now.
Another thing, again, I don't want to get into the technicals of it, but in reading on Twitter, some of the complaints about the Frontline documentary was that they talked about – everyone thought it was going to be about daily fantasy sports, 60 minutes, no commercials, just daily fantasy sports, and half of the program ended up being kind of chasing down illegal gambling across the entire world via the internet. And so it wasn't – it was kind of a 50-50 split, but one of the things that I think was informative about the Frontline documentary that you can bring that illegal gambling element to this discussion is one of the illegal websites had servers in the United States so that United States people could get quicker access to gamble offshore. It seems like if New York bans it, but New Jersey allows it, Massachusetts allows it with regulation and so forth, there's going to be lots of technical ways, and there's going to be torrents and all these different things where even though you're not allowed to play from New York, New Yorkers are still going to be able to find a way to backdoor it anyway. So it seems like this, like you said, the AG is running for whatever higher office he wants next. A year and a half after this all dust gets settled, it seems like at least 60 or 70% of New Yorkers, even if it was banned, are still going to be able to play anyway. I don't know how they stop that anyway. That's, I guess, a question in practice versus reality as well.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, and that's why this is no easy solution for this situation, because if it was some sort of federal mandate, it would be a lot more uniformity as far as regulations and taxation and whatnot. But since each state has a hand in this whole thing, and each AG has their own personal goals, and some states already have gambling more than others, there are a lot of variables here that need to be addressed, and that's why this is such a difficult discussion right now.
But to put it down into a yes or a no, it looks like DFS is still going to be around in some form with some kind of changes, maybe not in some states, but it will be somewhere. So let's say it takes a year. Let's say it takes 2 years. Let's say 5 years from now, DFS will still be here. People will still be playing it. It just may look different than it does today. Is that sort of the roundabout answer to our day?
Yes, absolutely. I have no doubt about that. DFS is not going anywhere. It's just way too big. It's way too popular. They can't shut down such a huge industry like this. They can regulate it. They can make some changes. But the market speaks, and the market loves it. So it's going to be around. It just may look a little bit different. And I think 5 years is really that time frame that we're talking about here. So the next 5 years is probably going to be it's going to be interesting to see how things evolve.
And also, people like my father, they'll never play DFS. Not because my father likes fantasy sports to some degree. He doesn't play it anywhere near as much as I do, but he plays. I have a friends and family yearly league. He plays in that every single year, participates in the draft. He's in his 60s. So he plays fantasy sports, but he's not his generation isn't the generation that is booming right now. But as my generation gets older and we get into our 60s, I would assume we're going to still playing it. And the kids that are younger and then the kids who aren't even playing yet, they're going to come up and they're all going to play it. So it seems like there's, as the generations move along, the 50 and up who aren't playing it anything as large as the numbers as my generation is, I would guess, there's a lot of room for growth. That being said, if 20 or 30,000 people are signing up every single day, even if there are changes or regulations, how much bigger can DFS get from what it is now? What kind of growth are we looking at, do you think?
I think there's still a lot of growth. And some of the things you talk about are interesting because it's not so much the game itself, but it's a lot has to do with life cycle. I mean, I've been doing this now for 30 years, and I can tell you that when I first started, I was in my 20s, and it was exciting, and I had a lot of free time. I was first getting married. I didn't have any kids yet. I spent a lot of time playing fantasy, and then, when I started having my kids, my discretionary time started withering away. So the leagues that I were in that had a lot of complicated rules started to become more of a burden to play. So I started opting, moving from a 12-team AL or NL league to more of a mixed league where I didn't have to know quite as many players. And as I got older and memory starts going, I'm pushing 60 now myself. I start gravitating towards leagues where I don't have to know the second string catcher on the Seattle Mariners because, first of all, I don't really care. And second of all, I want to be able to enjoy fantasy because it's always been an enjoyable game for me. And so I gravitate towards those formats that make more sense. And DFS is sort of a universal format when it comes to that because you're going in on a single night. You're basically picking, the best from the best players. Even your worst player on your roster on any given night is playing that night, so he has to be somewhat of a regular or getting into a starting lineup. So you don't need to know the second string whatever on whatever team because you're drafting from a shallower pool, and that fits just about every lifestyle, every life cycle. So, I think that opens things up incredibly for anybody to play the game.
It's interesting you say that because ever since I started writing for BaseballAmerica.com and RotoExperts.com, I'm more knowledgeable, I'm more in tune, I know more second and third string catchers than I ever knew before, but yet I'm probably not performing as well in a lot of my fantasy leagues. So I'm more informed, more knowledgeable, and yet I'm less active and less successful in a lot of my friends and family leagues. And it's interesting you say that about when you were not married and didn't have kids and how it changed your parents. That's the exact thing that my father always says about golf. When he was younger, before he had children, he would golf. He played golf in high school. He almost played in college. Then once he got married, once he started to have kids, he didn't play golf for a variety of years. And then once we got older and moved on with our lives, then he picked it up again. It's sort of, for my dad's generation, or at least for my father, it's a golf. What you're saying, it's for fantasy sports.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what happens. And, there was a time when I played maybe 8 or 12 leagues during a year. And through my late 30s and 40s, I was down to maybe about 2 or 3 leagues. That was my max that I could keep track of. And now, you know, my kids are grown. They're out of the house. And I've sold my business. I'm doing more freelance stuff, and I've got more discretionary time, taking on more leagues and having more fun with it. So, it's kind of the way it goes with this hobby.
And to wrap it up in a little bow, and we'll let you go here, we really appreciate you taking the time. But yearly leagues, I like, as I said, I think dynasty leagues are the most fun. I write about prospects. I talk about prospects. So I like building a minor league system as well as a major league system and looking not only to now but the future and the strategies that go involved in that. You know, should I trade Lucas Giolito for Jose Fernandez? I mean, those kinds of things are interesting, in my opinion, the most interesting. But what do you, with DFS growing to the crescendo that it's at right now, and with all that growth it still has to go, what's the impact on yearlies? Some people are saying DFS is going to kill yearlies. Regulation comes in and makes things murky. What are your thoughts on how yearly leagues will inevitably be impacted going forward?
I think they're always going to exist. I think there's still a large percentage of the population. I mean, still a majority of the fantasy playing populations who play in yearly as opposed to DFS. So they're not going away. They might be marginalized a little bit. I mean, when we moved from primarily a 4x4 rotisserie game to a 5x5, there are still people who play 4x4. I mean, again, they've been marginalized, but they're still there. I don't think yearly will be marginalized quite that much, but there's still a good percentage of the population that plays that format and enjoys it. So they'll be there.
Yeah, I had Lenny Melnick on one of my podcasts a while back, and he mentioned 4x4, and he told me what the categories were, and I had never even heard of that. So I've been playing fantasy for probably 20 years, and I hadn't even heard of 4x4 and heard, what are the categories for 4x4? Because he said, I forget what he told me, but what are the 4x4 categories?
Well, it's the same by five as 5x5, except that there's no runs on the offense side, and there's no strikeouts on the pitching side. So, so it changes the type of player that has value. Closers have far more value in the 4x4 game because saves is now 1 out of 4 categories instead of 1 out of 5. Strikeout pitchers have less value in the 4x4 game because strikeouts is not a category, and it changes the valuations a little bit. It allows for some different types of strategies that you can't do in a 5x5, like you can punt wins and focus just on skills measures for pitchers and still do pretty well because you don't have to stock up on strikeouts, so things like that. Again, different formats, different types of strategies, all still good games, but once 5x5 came around, it took off, and it's become the standard.
And I think we're getting closer to 6x6, where you want to add on base percentage or people want to change them and get into the more sabermetric element. So, one of my leagues is 6x6, one of my dynasty leagues, and it uses a category that nobody would ever recommend using, which is innings pitched. I think you would probably call that moronic. Most people call it moronic. I actually find it intriguing as far as strategy goes, but I don't think anyone would advocate for having innings pitched as a category. But nonetheless, I play in a 6x6.
Well, it's funny you say that. When things started first moving to 5x5, innings pitched was the suggested fifth category instead of strikeouts. And the whole point being that you wanted pitchers who were on the mound more than others. And it didn't matter, you know, what they were doing on a mound, but it's the pitchers who got the innings that had more valuable, whether they struck out guys or not. So it's interesting. Strikeouts ended up being the de facto standard, but the innings was the first suggestion in moving towards 5x5. You know, people think more is better. I'd love to play in a 3x3 league just to see, you know, what it would be like, because the more categories you have, the more moving pieces, the more things you have to control. It's tougher to make trades because you have so many considerations. It's more of a complicated game with more categories, but there's more is better, as this seems to be a underlying sentiment with that.
When it comes to the sabermetric look at things, if you were going to add a category like war, I hate war. I think it's an intriguing analysis of things, and I take it for what it's worth. But I think there are definite limitations. But if you were going to add one of these, you know, FIP or XFIP or any of these other advanced sabermetric kind of categories, what ones do you think you would recommend adding if you're going to go that way? I think eventually 5 years from now we're going to. I'm just curious, which ones do you think are the most viable or are the best representative of fantasy sports, and which ones do you think should be added, and which ones do you think will be as we slowly progress forward, progression or regress, depending on your opinion. But what are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I hope that doesn't happen. I think half of the enjoyment of playing this is being able to sit down and watch a ball game and know that when your player gets up and hits a home run, that's, you know, a home run and how many RBIs and a run and what impact that's going to have on the categories or the points or what have you. Once we start moving towards more esoteric-type gauges that, although they might be more accurate portrayals of skill, you lose that element to being able to watch the game and know exactly what every event has an impact on your team. You know, if we do move in that direction, clearly, you know, a gauge like XFIP is better than ERA. There are actually expected batting average could replace batting average, which XBA is a gauge that uses context-independent metrics to measure a player what he should be batting. I mean, things like that to do a better job of measuring traditional gauges, I think, might have greater acceptance. But again, I want to be able to sit down and know that when Albert Pujols hits a home run, what exactly effect is going to have on my team.
I agree 100%. I hope that's the case. Last question. You got me tempted, so we're going longer and longer. I like to blame the guest for being interesting for when I hold you for too long. So I appreciate you taking the time, and I'm going to blame you for being interesting rather than blame me for just rambling on and on. But
that's
my
right.
Problem with war and advanced metrics, and again, I'm not an anti-sabermetrician. The more metrics that give you a better idea of people being underappreciated, I'm all for that. But one of my problems and what I think is crazy about what Jason Hayward got as far as the contract goes is I have no confidence or trust in the defensive metrics. And I think there are a lot of people out there that don't even realize that there's a subjective or an objective nature to it. The people evaluating defensive metrics are essentially imposing their opinions rather than purely taking it as fact. And I think a lot of people, or at least some people out there, think that it's just 1 + 1 = 2, that the defensive metrics work that way and that sabermetrics works that way. And that's not actually the case. These categories or these things, some of them are just 1 + 1, you know, just XFIP and things like that are just purely independent of things and they do the calculus. But there is a subjective element to it, and that's my problem. How accurate do you think the defensive metrics are right now? Because I don't have any confidence in them, and that's one of my problems with things like war.
Yeah, we've come a long way with defensive metrics, and I think we've still got a long way to go. Part of the problem is that those who are developing the defensive metrics and those who are using them now are typically not fantasy leaguers. I mean, they're not designed to be fantasy friendly. They're more for the ball clubs to be able to more accurately evaluate the talent that they have or the talent that they're looking to acquire. And it doesn't have to be a precision in those metrics. I mean, just to get a general sense and being able to compare one player to another. And that's the problem, because fantasy needs precision. You need to be able to say a certain player is more valuable than this player, and it has to be along a rigidly measured continuum that you can use to evaluate. And Major league ball clubs don't look at it that way. They see guys. They don't see a guy as a 20 home run hitter. They see guys as somebody who can have moderate power. And they look at the defenders in a similar light. They don't look at them in rigid terms. They look at them in more broad terms. And so for them, these defensive metrics do the job that they're looking for. And again, these metrics are getting even better as time goes on. But, you know, fantasy leaguers, we have very specific needs, and those measures don't meet those needs. And quite frankly, even traditional measures don't meet the needs for fantasy leaguers, because the numbers do a great job of measuring what's already happened. But when it comes to predicting the future, you know, we go into our leagues and we have our ADPs and we have our average auction values, And what they end up being by the end of the year is usually nothing like what we expect them to be at the beginning of the year. And that's because players don't play to a level of precision when it comes to statistics. They just play in broad – their skills end up being expressed in very broad terms. And that's – actually, that's something I kind of write about in my new book. So we're trying to move away a little bit from the rigid statistics that we measure player performance and projections with, and moving towards looking at skills and risks in more general terms and try to evaluate players that way.
Yeah, why don't you tell them people, so since we're promoting your stuff, why don't you tell them about your new book so they know where to go and they know what it's about and they can hopefully go out and buy a few of them.
Sure. Actually, it's an online book, so it basically you have access to it when you pay for a membership to my website, ronchandler.com. And essentially, what it does is it looks at the building rosters using an accounting concept, a balance sheet. And all the players are basically represented as assets and liabilities, and you basically have a budget of how many assets you need to acquire and how many a maximum number of liabilities you can roster and still have a competitive roster, and you build your roster that way. So it's really a different concept in creating fantasy teams, and so far the response has been pretty good.
I imagine. Is there anything else we can promote for you before we let you go?
That's basically it. Just head on to ronchandler.com. Got a lot of interesting stuff there, some polls, some other articles that I've been posting. And since leaving Baseball HQ last year, it's become my new home for where I do most of my writing.
Great. Ron, I really appreciate it. Ron Schindler from ronchandler.com, author of The Baseball Forecaster. 30 years writing this book, awarded very deservingly this season by the FSWA. Also, Ron Schindler's other book, 2006. You can follow him on Facebook, ronchandler.baseball, and, of course, on Twitter, at Ron Schindler. Ron, I really appreciate you taking so much time out today talking with us. Interesting topic, and I love talking with you again. Very, very thankful that you were able to take some time today.
Thanks, Chris. It's been my pleasure.
All right, everybody. That's Ron Schindler talking a little bit of daily fantasy sports with us, amongst other things. Again, I ramble on. I can't stop talking when I get these interesting guests on. But Ron took the time out today. A lot of interesting topics covered. Hopefully you guys enjoyed it. We're going to be back another day, but you've been listening to a podcast to be named later. I'm your host, Chris Mitchell. If you'd like to follow us online, there's a lot of different ways you can do that. You can follow me on Twitter, at CJMitch73. If you want to get into the discussion with me about anything from baseball to fantasy sports of any kind, there's two pages on Facebook that you can go to for that. It's A Podcast to Be Named Later is one of those. That's what this podcast is about. I post links on there. Also, I do some writing for minorleagueball.com. So if you want to read any of that, I post that in the Facebook page. If you want to talk fantasy sports with me, I have a fantasy baseball podcast as well. Fantasy sports in general, but obviously we're talking baseball now. It's the rotoexperts.com fantasy sports show page. Just ask to be a member and you can talk fantasy sports with us on there. If you want to follow me or read any of my articles, I write for rotoexperts.com as well as baseballamerica.com, which is why I started out doing this interview, is that I'm in the process of writing an article for baseballamerica.com about the future of daily fantasy sports, and I wanted to get the perspective of some industry insiders. I also want to get a business perspective on things, so I've been calling some of the websites that have daily fantasy sports, and I'm also in the process of talking with some of the legal people that are involved across the nation where it comes to attorney general's offices and things like that, their legislations, their concerns, some of those things. So I'm going to hopefully have some interviews with there as well. I'm hoping they'll come on and do the podcast with me so I can give you some audio as well as just quotes for the article, but I don't know how successful that's going to be, but I'm going to do my best when it comes to that. At least get the quotes, at least get some insight from them and include that in the article. But I'm hoping that they'll come on the podcast and do a little bit of a conversation with me as well. But my hopes are not exactly high on that. It would be difficult to get a high-ranking member to come on here, but I'm hoping. I've got the calls in. I do have some connections, especially in Massachusetts, so it could happen. But that was our show today. Ron Schindler, if you want to follow him on Twitter, that's the easiest way. Follow Ron online on Twitter, at Ron Schindler. But that's our program for today. I appreciate everybody who tuned in and was listening in. And hopefully you'll be coming back and listening to our podcast in the future as well. If you want to follow me online as well, if you want to follow all of these podcasts, head on over to minorleagueball.com. That's where I've been doing my writing, and that's where these podcasts are appearing. So head on over there, minorleagueball.com. Chris Mitchell, A Podcast to Be Named Later. Thanks, everybody.